So please join me now in welcoming Katie Purvis-Roberts, Assistant Professor of Chemistry in the Joint Science Program, who will introduce tonight's speaker.
Good evening. Today we're very privileged to have Dr. Helen Caldicott with us so we can learn more about nuclear weapons and power and their impacts on human health and the environment. Dr. Caldicott is a physician. She graduated from the University of Adelaide Medical School, founded the Cystic Fibrosis Clinic at Adelaide Children's Hospital in 1975, and went on to become an instructor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and on the staff of Children's Hospital Medical Center until 1980. At this point, although she loved interacting with patients, she decided to work full-time on the prevention of nuclear war. Dr. Caldicott initially focused on grassroots organization to prevent nuclear war. And during the late 70s and early 80s, she co-founded the Physicians for Social Responsibility. It's an organization of over 23,000 doctors, which are committed to educating their colleagues about the danger of nuclear power, nuclear weapons, and nuclear war. In addition, she started similar organizations overseas, and the umbrella organization, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985. She also started the Women's Action for Nuclear Disarmament in the United States. Although she still supports grassroots level participation to rid the Earth of nuclear weapons and power, Dr. Caldicott realized that she needed a means to compete with conservative think tanks who support nuclear armament at the same level as them. And so as a result, she is the founder and president of the Nuclear Policy Research Institute in Washington, D.C. Their main goals are to educate the public through the mainstream media about the underestimated dangers of nuclear weapons and power programs and policies. Because of her work around the world, Dr. Caldicott has received many prizes and awards. For example, she has received 19 honorary doctoral degrees, was given the Lannan Foundation's 2003 Prize for Cultural Freedom, and was named one of the most influential women of the 20th century by the Smithsonian Institute. Linus Pauling, who is a Nobel laureate himself, even nominated her for the Nobel Peace Prize. In addition, she has authored 6 books about nuclear weapons and power, including her latest, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer, and has a couple of more books in the works. Dr. Caldicott is a strong voice for the struggle to rid the world of nuclear weapons and power, and with her optimistic nature and vision for the future, she is making the world we live in a better place. Again, we are very fortunate to have the opportunity to learn from her this evening, so please join me in welcoming Dr. Helen Caldicott.
Is my mic on? Yeah. I can't help but start off with this bottle in front of me. And I'm speaking now as a physician and a pediatrician, the person who invented plastic bottles and putting water in it to sell to you was brilliant. Soon we'll be walking around with oxygen cylinders on our back, buying air. I'm being facetious. These bottles contain phthalates. Phthalates are estrogen mimickers. The water sits, first you don't know where the water comes from. Sometimes they say it comes from Maine. If you read my book, If You Love This Planet, the mafia take toxic wastes up to Maine during the night and dump them into the aquifers. Coors beer comes from water which comes from an aquifer near Rocky Flats which has plutonium in it, and you'll learn about plutonium in a minute. You don't know where this water comes from. You do know that the water out of your tap is potable. You have been taught that the water really isn't very good coming out of your tap. That's not true. If you drink this water and it's been around in the bottle for a while, you're drinking phthalates which stimulate carcinoma of the breast, cancer of the breast, prostate cancer, and there are many little black girls now who are having early menarche. They get their periods at 5 and 6, and one of the reasons that we postulate is because they drink this stuff, but Coke as well out of plastic bottles. This is polycarbonate plastic, and Coke is quite corrosive. To make plastic, you make massive quantities of carcinogens that are put into the air, especially in poor areas in this country. It's ecological racism. And then this plastic is not biodegradable. So it's ecologically and medically contraindicated ever to drink water out of these bottles. I was actually with a man who's the head of the adolescent unit at LA Children's Hospital, and we talked about this last night. He brought it up. Okay, now I'm going to walk you through the medical effects of the nuclear fuel cycle. I first want to start with global warming. I know that, hands up those who haven't seen Al Gore's film, An Inconvenient Truth. Okay, those who haven't, you must see it. It's absolutely man. I'm telling you as a doctor, like, take your medicine and go and see the film. You will learn from that film that we don't have much time, that the Earth is in the intensive care unit, it's acutely ill, and we have to attend to it immediately or we're in serious trouble, as in the oceans may rise 20 feet in the next 10 years. And if that happens, your two reactors in California, San Onofre and Diablo Canyon, which are both built on earthquake faults, they would be drowned as the oceans rise 20 feet and there could be meltdowns at the reactors. And that could happen in 10 years. Now, I know that you've had a series of lectures about oil and peak oil. The truth is, the stark truth is, we have to stop burning oil. We have to stop driving our SUVs and our Hummers. I came out in a car, limousine tonight, that does 12 miles to the gallon. I do have a hybrid, which uses one third the amount of normal petrol, we call it petrol, that a normal car uses. But the fact is that it's the burning of oil that causes about more than 50% of CO2 and global warming gases. And there's an acute clinical emergency, and we've got to ban all cars and automobiles that use huge amounts of petrol. They need to be recycled, crushed and recycled. We need a massive program, the sort of program FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, would have set up for mass transit systems to be built in every single capital city of the country, like now, and which would employ hundreds of thousands, millions of people, raise the GDP, and help to stop people driving cars. We don't need huge supermarkets where we have to drive 20 miles to get a pint of milk or some bread. We need in our villages where you walk around the corner, you have a coffee, you meet Mrs. Brown, read the paper, and buy your meat and vegetables and the like. So the way society has been set up, particularly in this country, is antithetical to global survival. I won't go on about this because I don't have time to talk about global warming, but suffice it to say this is an acute emergency. It's not, well, in 2 years I might get a hybrid. It's that the government must be subsidising all of you to have Prius cars or hybrid cars. Is there money? Well, they're spending $70 billion every few months on killing people in Iraq. Apparently, according to some authors in The Lancet, the British Medical Journal, over 300 people have now already been slaughtered in Iraq. We've got to stop killing people. And that money should be transferred, and the $600 billion a year spent on weapons of mass destruction by the United States must be transferred to saving the planet. I write about weapons in this book, which has George Bush on the cover and Dick Cheney looking up at a nuclear explosion, and it's called The New Nuclear Danger, George Bush's Military-Industrial Complex. And I will get into nuclear weapons a little at the end of my talk and North Korea, okay? But to start with, I'll start with this whiteboard. I'm going to walk you through radiation, mutation, cancer, so you understand why I'm so concerned, and you'll understand what the nuclear industry really, really and truly is. And it's not a method of generating electricity, it's a method of generating carcinogens and mutagens that last forever and will cause epidemics of cancer. So therefore, it's medically contraindicated. It's a very serious issue. So let's start. Hands up those of you here who've never had an x-ray. Never, you've never been x-rayed? By your dentist? Okay, each dose of radiation you receive is dangerous, and each dose you receive is cumulative and adds to your risk of getting cancer. It's not high, but it's there. National Academy of Sciences came out with a report last year saying that there's no dose of radiation that's safe. You do not need a dental x-ray every year. In fact, you don't ever need a dental x-ray except if you've got a really sore tooth and an abscess on your tooth. I know because my ex-husband was a radiologist and they make a lot of money. Apparently the insurance companies pay for your teeth to get x-rayed. Just don't do it. Never have an unnecessary x-ray. If you have pneumonia, you need a diagnosis made so we can treat you and cure you, and we need an x-ray to look and see what is going on in your chest. So the biggest irradiators of the public at this time are doctors. I take responsibility for that. So there are basically four sorts of radiation. There are x-rays. Can you see that? I don't have a darker pen. Can you see the green? Okay. Now, x-rays are non-particulate radiation. So when the technician says, breathe in, hold it, and runs out of the room, that instant you become irradiated. That instant your genes can be damaged, but you do not become radioactive. When they irradiate food to prevent so-called spoiling with huge doses of radiation, the food does not become radioactive unless they spill some radiation on the food, which they sometimes do. Okay? Then there's gamma radiation, which is like x-rays, non-particulate, given off by radioactive materials made in a nuclear power plant. Then there's alpha radiation, which is particulate, so you have an atom, this is the GE symbol. GE makes good things for life, like refrigerators, clothes dryers, irons, nuclear power plants, and nuclear weapons. An alpha particle is composed of two protons and two neutrons. It's dense in mass, travels not very far. It will be stopped by a piece of paper. If you hold an alpha emitter in your hand, the dead layers in the epidermis of cells are not penetrated by the alpha particle to damage living cells in the dermis. But if you swallow or inhale an alpha emitter, it's highly mutagenic and carcinogenic. Then there's beta radiation, which is an electron emitted. So these are two particulate forms of radiation. These are non-particulate, but they all have the same mechanism in cells. They all can damage cells. Hands up those who don't know what a mutation is. Great. It's nice to have an educated audience. The normal cells of the body, the somatic cells, all have a nucleus with chromosomes, and in every nucleus there is a pair of genes which control the rate of cell division called the regulatory gene. And if they're damaged and mutated by either alpha, beta, gamma, or x-rays, the cell will sit in a latent phase for 5 to 60 years, which is called the latent period of carcinogenesis. It's incubation time for cancer. Which is why the nuclear industry get away with what they do. Because if I sneeze on you, in 2 days you're sneezing. The incubation time for cold or flu is short. For measles, it's 3 weeks. But for cancer, it's long. And how do we know? Because we took the guinea pig populations of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and we followed them until now, and they still are getting cancer. Different cancers have different incubation times. First, we saw a rise in leukemia at 5 years post-radiation, then 15 years solid cancers start appearing, breast, lung, thyroid, but even now, 60 years later, we're seeing cancers of the genital urinary tract and the bone marrow. So each cancer has a different incubation time. We're still learning. So that's the cryptogenic latent phase of cancer production. And we are seeing now clusters of cancers around old nuclear reactors, and they need to be old because they need to be operating for a while before people get their cancers. Each reactor, I'll get to this in a minute, continuously emits radioactive materials into the air and water all the time as they operate. Although the nuclear industry will tell you that they're emission-free, and it makes me very upset when scientists lie. If I lie in medicine about my patients, A, I might lose my patients, and B, I will be deregistered. I can't practice again. You can't lie about medicine, and you can't lie about these scientific problems. Okay, now the other cells in the body that are more important than the somatic cells are the sperm and egg. And they have half the number of genes, you know, the haploid number. Every single gene in the egg and sperm is important, because that's why we are who we are. Although 93% of our genes are the same as a chimpanzee, so we actually don't understand a lot about genes yet. But we all carry several hundred genes for disease. 1 in 25 of us carry the gene for cystic fibrosis. That is my specialty. And you don't know, you carry the gene,
until you mate with someone with the same gene, and then you have a pair of recessive genes for cystic fibrosis, and I have to come and tell you your baby has CF and may die soon, or when they're 10, or when they're 20. It's the most common lethal disease of childhood, genetic. There are over 16,000 genetic diseases now described. We all carry several hundred genes for disease, and as we increase radiation in the environment, so more and more genes will be mutated to cause disease. But then, how did evolution occur? When the Earth was much hotter, radiologically speaking, and more radioactive, there were a lot of mutations. Most mutations are deleterious and cause disease and death, but some are advantageous, like fish developing lungs and birds developing wings. And we evolved because of advantageous mutations over eons of time. But it takes huge, huge numbers of years for advantageous mutations to survive in a deleterious environment. Most mutations cause disease. So under no circumstances is it medically indicated to increase radiation in the environment or to have unnecessary x-rays. And we are pretty bad in irradiating people. Okay, so that's a basic biological lesson. So let's go back to nuclear power now. And nuclear power plants, you know, you hear from the industry that they're emission-free. But you see, nuclear power plants have to be fueled. And the fuel is uranium. And uranium is in the ground. And in Australia, we have 40% of the world's natural uranium. We will not have nuclear power plants in Australia. It's too dangerous for us. We just export the uranium so everyone else can have the carcinogenic benefits of nuclear power and radioactive waste. We are an immoral country at the moment. And I have to say I'm embarrassed and ashamed to be Australian at the moment. I've always been very proud of being Australian, but I'm not now. Okay, so let's talk about uranium. Uranium is in the ground. It has to be dug up millions of tons of rock and ore to get enough uranium to fuel reactors. Uranium is radioactive. It's an alpha emitter, very carcinogenic. And it decays to a series of daughters, one of which is radium. Who's the person who first isolated radium? Madame Curie. Radium-226 is an alpha emitter and highly carcinogenic. Madame Curie died of leukemia, which is cancer of the white blood cells, because she used to walk around with a little bit of radium in her pocket playing with it, because she was fascinated with it. And radium is a calcium analog, so it goes to bone. So here's a femur, and it deposits in the femur and next to the bone-forming cells, which can be mutated to form bone cancer, or to stem cells in the bone marrow, which are precursors of the white blood cells. So leukemia means white blood, leuko, white blood, and you get trillions of white blood cells that grow in an uncontrolled fashion, and that's a cancer. So it can cause either leukemia or cancer. Her daughter died of leukemia too, and she worked with radium. The other daughter is radon, which is a gas, and that's an alpha emitter. And in the past, 30 to 50% of men who've mined uranium have died of lung cancer. And many of them are Navajo Indians, because in America, the uranium happens to be on Navajo tribal land. And when you take the uranium and you leave all this stuff behind, and they're called tailings, millions of tons of rock and ore that are radioactive, emitting radon gas into the atmosphere and radium into the water. And when radium gets into the water, it bioconcentrates thousands of times, hundreds of times, by orders of magnitude, at each step of the food chain. Algae, crustaceans, little fish, big fish, and then people eat the fish. And it concentrates further in our bodies. That's called bioconcentration. So the people, the Navajo Indians, who live around these tailings piles, and there are millions of tons of them, have a higher than normal incidence of cancer and actually genetic abnormalities, and I've documented that in the book. If you bury the tailings back in the ground from whence they came, they're safe. But there's never been any reconstitution or reclamation of the land where they dig the uranium up because it's too expensive and they won't make a profit. Now, the uranium has two isotopes, 238 and 235. This one is present in only 0.7%, And it must be enriched to 3% for use in nuclear power, which is what Iran is doing. And if it's enriched to 50% or more, you can make bombs, and there's no evidence that Iran is doing that, according to the International Atomic Energy Commission. So left behind after you enrich the uranium is this stuff, uranium-238, which is called depleted uranium. It's not depleted of radiation, it's depleted of uranium-235, and it's magic. A, it's free. B, it's 1.7 times more dense than lead. C, the military found it. And they've fashioned it into solid shells of 10 pounds. And as momentum equals mass by velocity, you have a very dense shell shot up at high speed from a tank, which penetrates the other fellow's tank like a hot knife through butter. But when it hits a tank, it burns. And up to 80% of the 10 pounds turns into aerosolized particles less than 5 microns in diameter that are inhaled into the terminal air passages and land just here to irradiate the cells. It's an alpha emitter. Now, when America went in 1991 into Iraq under the direction of George I, they used about 360 tons of this ordnance. Called ordnance. And they used it in a town, near a town called Basra, which is in the south of Iraq. And my colleagues, pediatricians, noticed 4 years later an increased incidence of childhood cancer. Children are much more sensitive to the carcinogenic effects of radiation than adults because their cells are actively mitosing and the genes are being synthesized. And in that state, they're very vulnerable to mutating. Now, in Basra, the incidence of childhood cancer has gone up 700%, or 7 times. And the incidence of severe congenital anomalies, babies born with no brains, I've delivered such a baby, they have a little nubbin of midbrain on the base of their skull, they cough, they cry, they sneeze, they suck. They might live for a week and then they die. Babies with severe midface deformities, like single eyes, babies with no arms, like babies that were born from thalidomide, when their mothers took thalidomide. It's gone up 700%. So the mothers are too terrified to deliver their babies for fear of what will emerge from their vaginas. They're terrified. The half-life of uranium-238 is 4.5 billion years. So the United States is conducting a nuclear war in Iraq. There aren't nuclear explosions, but it's scattering radiation in the cradle of civilization where arithmetic was developed and writing and the law and the like. And those people will be subjected to these diseases forevermore. And you know, not many people know about it. I wrote an article for the New York Times about 5 years ago, an op-ed piece. And they sent it back to me and said, quotes, we are unable to use this. Passive tense, not we won't. As if there was someone telling them that they can't use it. This time when they went in, they've used over at least 2,000 tons. They're still using it. They used it in Fallujah. As at the end of the battle in Fallujah, where half a million people lived in Fallujah? Or 250,000? 250,000. People, they all fled, but many were killed. They leveled the town, but in the last few days, they went along the road and lobbed 2 DU shells, depleted uranium shells, in each house and building. They've used a lot of it in Baghdad, where there are 5 million people, half of whom are children. So this is a pediatric war, and it's beyond a war crime. Okay, so let's move on now from Iraq. They also used it in Kosovo and Afghanistan. And there's a huge cover-up. Now, when the uranium is enriched, it's made into little pellets, like here's a bit of chalk, the same size as a piece of chalk, I've missed out a couple of steps. You have to mill the uranium and crush it. And of course, to mine uranium, what do you use to mine uranium? What fuel? Oil and gasoline. And to mill the uranium, you use more oil and gasoline. And then it's taken to Paducah, Kentucky, where it's enriched How do you spell, is it Kentucky? K-N? Kentucky. I was just near there. Huh? K-Y. Sorry. Okay, now in Paducah, Kentucky, they enrich the free world's uranium there, and they've got two huge coal-fired plants that supply the electricity to enrich the uranium. So when you burn coal, what do you make? CO2. So what else do they use? To cool the process, they use CFC gas. So 93% of the CFC gas in America, 1-14, is emitted from this plant. But CFC is banned. Why? Because it destroys the ozone. In Australia, we've got hardly any ozone. We've got an epidemic of malignant melanoma and skin cancers and cataracts and the like. So it was banned under the Montreal Protocol, but the nuclear industry was, quotes, grandfathered. I didn't know what that meant until I found out they're allowed to do it. CFC gas, though, apart from destroying ozone, is 10,000 to 20,000 times more potent as a heat trapper than carbon dioxide. So in fact, this part of the fuel cycle, the front end from uranium mining right through, is a massive producer of global warming gases. And yet you will see in Scientific American on NPR, the Nuclear Energy Institute, underwritten by the nuclear power companies, says that it's clean and is the answer to global warming. Also, people say it's the answer to oil shortage. Oil is not used to generate electricity, it's used to drive cars. So to compare electricity production with transportation is like comparing apples and oranges. It's just fallacious. Okay, so then you've got enriched uranium. Then you make it into ceramic pellets and you pack it into fuel rods, which are half an inch wide and 12 feet long. And you take the uranium fuel along to the nuclear power plant. And I just went by train past San Onofre recently to, there are actually three reactors there sitting on an earthquake fault. So here's the reactor. And you pack 100 tons of uranium into the reactor. And it's submerged in water. And you pull out the moderating rods. And when you do that, the uranium reaches critical mass and the atoms start breaking apart spontaneously, producing 200 new radioactive isotopes that didn't ever exist in nature till we fissioned uranium. And it creates terrific heat, and the heat boils the water. And the steam that's generated is taken off by a turbine, a pipe which turns a turbine that's generating electricity. So all a nuclear power plant is designed to do is to boil water. That's all. It's like cutting a pound of butter with a chainsaw. They only run for 20 to maybe 40 years before they're so radioactive they can't be operated anymore. So the transient product of nuclear power is electricity. Then I don't want anyone else to leave the room, okay? Even if I'm boring. Okay? Even if you have to go to the bathroom. Because this is an important lecture, like it's your future. Yeah, the transient product is this, but the real product is radioactive waste. Now, every year they remove 1/3 of the spent fuel rods, which is 30 tons, and they're terribly hot. Each reactor uses 1 million gallons of water a minute to cool it. If you lose your external electricity supply, you lose the cooling water and the reactor melts down, which is what happened in Sweden the other day when electricity struck the external electricity supply. The four diesel generators wouldn't start, and for 20 minutes they had no cooling water, and they got to 2 minutes of a meltdown, 2 minutes. At the last minute, they got two diesel generators to start, and they started the cooling water. So Sweden almost had a catastrophe the same size as Chernobyl, and they were so freaked out they closed down half the reactors. You didn't get this in your media, did you? No, but it was all over Europe 5 weeks ago. The next meltdown will signal the end of nuclear power forever. So anyone who's investing in it, and I know you're not, is foolish. One. Two, Wall Street won't touch nuclear power because it's too dangerous. And too much of a gamble. Standard & Poor's won't invest in it. It's a socialised industry. It's totally paid for by you. In a capitalist economy, it's a totally socialized industry, and I go into that in the second chapter. So every year they take out 30 tons of spent fuel, which is terribly radioactive. If you stand next to one spent fuel rod, radioactive rod, for a couple of seconds, you'll get a lethal dose of gamma radiation and die with your hair falling out, vomiting and bleeding to death with acute radiation illness. And they're thermally hot, and they must be cool continuously for many decades, because if they're not, they too will melt down. Now, they don't know where to put the radioactive waste, so some of the cooling pools, which they euphemistically call swimming pools, have 2 to 30 times as much radiation as the reactor itself. When you fission uranium, it becomes 1 billion times more radioactive. And in the reactor is as much long-lived radiation as that released by the explosion of 1,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs. In the cooling pools, it's twice to 30 times that amount. And often the cooling pools are on the roof of the reactors, open to terrorist intrusion and attack. Or at Santa Onofre, they're sitting there. I could easily, if I'd had a shoulder-held missile launcher, penetrated the cooling pools and caused a meltdown, which could have destroyed Los Angeles if the wind was blowing in the right direction, and 23 million people could have been sentenced to death. It's terribly easy to melt a reactor down. I could do it within hours. You can destroy the external electricity supply. I was outside Indian Point reactors on the Hudson, 25 miles from Manhattan, 35 miles, the other day in Bobby Kennedy's boat. And if I'd been a Timothy McVeigh suicidal person and I had a little speedboat packed with explosives, I could have driven it in to the two huge cooling pipes that each suck in 1 million gallons a minute, broken the cooling pipes, and with ours we would have had a meltdown, and if the wind was blowing towards New York, that would be the end of New York forevermore. No one could ever live there again. And indeed the terrorists had targeted the two Indian Point reactors, but they thought certainly they'd be protected by missile batteries, so they didn't go into them. Do you know that the security at nuclear power plants has not been increased since 9/11? Yet they almost make us take our clothes off at the airport. You know, men are walking around holding their pants up in bare feet, and, you know, it's sort of, it's not very pleasant. And they're wanding babies. So the Department of Homeland Security, we have to know a lot of that money's been funneled off into friends of Halliburton and Cheney and Bush, but they're not protecting us. These reactors are guarded by guards who work 12 hours a day, who go to sleep on the job, and they have mock terrorist attacks, and over 50% of the time the mock terrorists get into the control room. I could get a job in a control room as a reactor operator and melt the reactor down in a flash. I could take a few months of training, but it's very easy. Why there hasn't been a meltdown yet, I don't know. Terrorists do not need nuclear weapons or dirty bombs. They've got them deployed in 103 nuclear power plants around America. Why have we got nuclear power? Why is it socialist? Why is it paid for by the you? Well, because the men who made the first bombs were racked by guilt. I knew them. Do you know the first bomb, what its name was that they ever blew up? It was called Trinity. It's named after the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. And there was a possibility that when it blew up, the whole atmosphere could be rendered critical and the Earth could be enveloped in one nuclear explosion and everyone would die. And they went ahead anyway and did it. The probability was low, but it was definitely there. And if it didn't work, the telegram to the president was to read, "It's a girl." But it did work. And the telegram read, "It's a boy." So there was sexism involved in the nuclear industry right from the start. And it is profound, the sexism, and I won't go into it now, but we talked about it at dinner, didn't we? So when Robert Oppenheimer, who led the Manhattan Project, watched that bomb blow up, he knew they'd captured the energy inside the stars. And he muttered to himself from the Bhagavad Gita, "I have become death, the destroyer of worlds," knowing that we now had the capacity to destroy life on the planet. And those men were so guilty about Hiroshima, which killed 120,000 people in a flash of light. A little boy was reaching up to catch a red dragonfly on his hand against the blue of the sky, and there was a blinding flash, and he literally disappeared, turned into gas, and left his shadow on the pavement, which is now in the museum in Hiroshima. And a lot of people who survived Hiroshima, there was a woman running, holding her baby, and she and the baby had been turned into a charcoal statue. It was unbelievably dreadful. A lot of people who survived Hiroshima on the periphery of the bomb ran to the only Christian center in Japan, thinking America would never bomb that, and they got there just in time for the second bomb on Nagasaki. In toto, 200,000 people were killed in a flash, and thus began the age of nuclear genocide. And the men who designed the bombs felt so guilty, they thought if they could harness atoms for peace, then they'd feel better. And I used to argue with them because they knew about radioactive waste, but they were sort of attached to it in a sort of a frenzy so that they could die with a clear conscience. Most of them did not, I think. I want to talk about four of the isotopes made in reactors. Radioactive iodine. A lot of that got out at Three Mile Island, which is 13 miles from Hershey's chocolates. They built two huge nuclear power plants in the richest dairy area of the country, just next to Hershey's chocolates, where the cows graze. There was so much radioactive iodine in the milk, Hershey's powdered the milk for 2 months. Because the half-life of I-131 is 8 days, so it's around for 6 weeks. So in 2 months, it had faded away to nothing. What happens is the iodine lands on the soil, and the grass bioconcentrates it by orders of magnitude. The cows come along, and I can't draw a cow, really. I can draw the udder. So the cows eat the grass, and it bioconcentrates further in the milk. Then it either goes to the Hershey's chocolate factory, or a pregnant woman, a lactating woman, might drink the milk and it bioconcentrates in her breast, and it goes only to one gland in the body. What's that? The thyroid gland. And it causes thyroid cancer. Over 8,000 people near Chernobyl, 8,200, have had their thyroids totally removed for thyroid cancer, and that's the tip of the iceberg. We're going to see much more. But other materials got out at Three Mile Island and Chernobyl. One of them is called strontium-90, which has a half-life of 28 years, so it's around, you'll multiply the half-life by 20, 600 years. It's toxic. It's a calcium analog, so it goes to bone, where it causes bone cancer and leukemia. It's a beta and a gamma emitter. This is too. Okay? Cesium-137 is a potassium analog, and all our cells are rich in potassium, for those biochemists in the audience. It's got a half-life of 30 years, so it's around for 600 years. Much of the food in Europe is now contaminated with these two isotopes and many others, including a lot of cesium. There are over 300 farms in Wales in Britain farming lambs, and the lambs are so full of cesium they can't sell them on the market. So they send them to non-radioactive pastures, hoping that the cesium will be diluted so they can sell them. 40% of the European landmass is radioactive and will remain so for hundreds of years, but it's spotty. The fallout came down when it rained, you know? So Sweden got a lot. The reindeers are very radioactive because the lichen concentrates cesium and the reindeers eat the lichen, but it's all over Europe. I do not eat European food and I don't drink French wine. The French, 80% of their electricity comes from nuclear power. I've got a French son-in-law. The French, they don't get it. They love their food, they love their wine, but they're an agrarian society, but each reactor emits radioactive materials, and I'll get to that in a minute as it operates. Now, I'll just talk about plutonium. Who is Pluto? The god of the underworld or the dog? It's the god of the underworld. Alpha, most carcinogenic substance known, 10 to the minus 6 grams, a millionth of a gram is carcinogenic, but when they injected it into beagle dogs, they didn't find a dose low enough that didn't give all the dogs cancer, 10 to the minus 9 grams. Hypothetically, if you took a few pounds, you can't, But put that material in every person's lung on Earth, that's the carcinogenic dose for everyone on Earth. It's handled like iron by the body. The body thinks it's iron. So it causes lung cancer, liver cancer, bone cancer and leukemia because the hemoglobin is in the bone marrow, right? Full of iron, hemoglobin molecule, causes the blood to be red. It crosses the placenta into the developing embryo, where, like the drug thalidomide, it can kill a cell that's going to form, here's a little tiny fetus, the left side of the brain or the septum of the heart or the arm. And that's called teratogenesis, damage of a genetically chromosomally normal fetus. And last but not least, it has a predilection for the testicles and it tends to deposit next to the spermatogonia, the precursors of the sperm, and it's extremely mutagenic. So a lot of people in the Northern Hemisphere have a tiny load of plutonium in their testicles now from the fallout that's coming down still from the weapons testing from Russia and America. The fallout's still in the stratosphere. They did it so they could blow each other up. And I'll get to that in a minute. So you can see there could be congenital anomalies passed on generation to generation induced by plutonium. While the plutonium lives on and the man gets cremated and out the chimney goes the plutonium to get into someone else's testicle, ad infinitum for the rest of time. You see? So you can see there'll be an exponential increase in genetic disease forevermore. Each reactor makes 500 pounds of this material a year, and all you need is 10 pounds to make yourself a bomb. So any country that has a nuclear power plant has the capability, hypothetically, to make 50 new bombs a year. So nuclear power plants are bomb factories. So the International Atomic Energy Agency says, you're not allowed to make bombs, you little countries. We're the only ones who can have the bombs. But would you like a nice nuclear power plant? And they promote nuclear power. It's like a Dr. Doolittle push me, pull you animal. It makes no sense at all. Now let's talk about a normally functioning reactor because they say that they don't emit anything, which is not true. A reactor continuously emits every second of every day radioactive gases called noble gases that are inert, but is that how you spell noble? Yeah. Krypton, like Superman, xenon, and argon. And although they don't combine biochemically in the body, when you inhale them, say there's an inversion system and the fog hangs low over the reactor, and you live near the reactor and you're immersed in a cloud of radioactive gases, you inhale them and it goes through the pulmonary epithelium into the bloodstream. And these are very fat-soluble gases. So they tend to go to the abdominal fat pad and upper thighs. And what organs are located in that area? The gonads, the testicles and the ovaries. So people who live, and they're very high energy gamma emitters, people who live near reactors therefore are at risk of having their sperm and eggs irradiated. The other material they emit with impunity is tritium. Tritium is radioactive hydrogen, and it's really interesting. It's very reactive, and the only thing that stops tritium escaping is gold, because it's so dense. But tritium will get through every other container. And a reactor can't operate without all the time, every second, releasing tritium into the air and into the cooling water, where it bioconcentrates back in the food chain. Tritium combines with oxygen to form tritiated water, which, if you're immersed in a fog cloud near the reactor, goes straight through your skin. The skin doesn't let anything through, but tritium gets through. It gets through the lung and the bowel. And it's very mutagenic. It's a soft beta emitter, so the surrounding tissues absorb all the radiation, causes brain cancers and all sorts of cancers in the body. The nuclear industry, because you've got a leak at San Onofre, I think, of tritium into the underground water, but there are leaks everywhere, all around the country, into the water, because the cooling water from the cooling pools leaks into the underground water, and there's a lot of tritium. And the industry says, don't worry, it's only hydrogen, really. But they're really scared about it. And if you look up Journal of Health Physics, there's a huge literature on tritium, because they're very worried about it. But they will reassure you and say, and do you know, remember when there's a leak in a reactor or an accident, they say it's below regulatory concern. They say it's okay, you know, that the levels of, there are no radiation levels that are safe. None. And what really upsets me is the way the nuclear industry lies, whereas when I debate with generals about nuclear war, the generals know what a bomb dropping on a city does. You know, it can vaporise millions of people and burn millions of people, and we're on the same wavelength. And generals don't tend to like nuclear weapons because they spoil their wars, because they won't have any more wars if they have a nuclear war. Whereas the nuclear industry, and I was on NPR the other day with Margot Adler debating with a nuclear energy guy, and he lied. You know, it's hard when someone lies because you can't, if you say that's not true, he'll say yes it is. And he has a very nice, deep radio voice, male. So the more upset he gets, the deeper his voice becomes, and the more upset I can't become, the higher my voice goes. And so I tend to not have credibility with the audience because the tone of the voice matters. I could go on and on about how they lie, but I won't at the moment. Okay, so I've done plutonium. So this waste, this radioactive waste, is a big problem. You've got 50,000 tons of incredibly radioactive waste sitting at the cooling pools around the country, and no one knows what to do with it. So they had a meeting a few years ago to work out which state was going to get radioactive waste. And at the meeting, Ed Markey told me, Ed Markey is a congressman from Massachusetts, and if the Democrats get the House back, he's going to be a very senior member. I've known him for years. He said that each state had two members, but Nevada only had one. At the meeting, so Nevada got the joy of storing the country's radioactive waste. So they found a mountain in Nevada called Yucca Mountain, which I thought was an appropriate name, transected by 32 earthquake faults. And it's made of pumice, which is very permeable. They've spent $8 billion so far digging big holes in it to put the radioactive waste, but there's a lot of fraudulent data, so they may not use it. But to get all the waste over there from all the reactors in the country, they're going to have 1,500 shipments a year of waste through the cities and highways for the next 30 years. And that's called the Mobile Chernobyl Bill. Because if I want to destroy Chicago, and I'm a terrorist, I just bust one of the containers with a missile, and much of Chicago will be uninhabitable forevermore. So you can imagine this waste leaking over time. And we're talking about 500,000 years because the half-life of plutonium is 24,400 years. And there's nothing you can do about that. That's a physical fact. So it's around for 500,000 years. And they say, well, we'll find the answer to radioactive waste storage. We're scientists. How can we have the intellectual arrogance to say, because we're going to all be dead soon, in terms of this, to say that we can store radioactive waste safely for 500,000 years through geological time frames and ice ages and global warming? Don't forget, when the oil runs out, how are our descendants going to transport radioactive waste? They're going to be left with huge witches' cauldrons and vats of bubbling, thermally hot radioactive waste with no oil to keep it cool or transport it or store it. And that only occurred to me the other day. Talk about peak oil. Do you think George Bush understands this? Or Dick Cheney? Most of these people are scientifically illiterate. And we must have scientific literates now in politics who understand what's going on. So Yucca Mountain is very serious, but you can imagine years hence, generations hence, people waking up in the morning, the breast milk is already radioactive. The babies are drinking radioactive breast milk and they're getting cancer at 5 instead of 60 because they're exposed to radioactive isotopes from the start. Babies being born deformed or with genetic disease. That's the legacy of nuclear power. Now, everything I've said to you is accurate. I just spoke recently to my alma mater at Harvard Medical School, to Children's Hospital Medical Center, where the most brilliant pediatricians are, 100 of them. I walked them through this whole thing in a bit more detail, and they were absolutely devastated. People I've never seen show any emotion before were just bright red saying, but what are we going to do? So this is a medical problem. And in medicine, if you have a disease that's incurable, you must prevent it. The reason we don't get polio now is that Jonas Salk discovered the polio virus with Sabin, and they developed an immunization, so you don't get polio. We prevent it. But cancer's a hard thing to treat. Most adult cancers we can't cure. And if you've ever known anyone who's died of cancer, my father died in 3 weeks of cancer, he was 51, you'll know what I'm talking about. Or if you've ever delivered a deformed baby, or you've had to tell a mother who's given birth to her first baby and she's 40 that the baby has Down syndrome. We're dealing with the coalface of human existence and life and death now. Now, just briefly go on. This book deals with what we're going to do. I'm putting together a roadmap now for a carbon-free, nuclear-free future, and it will consist of an array of solar. Every house should have a solar system on it, subsidised by the federal government. Every house should have a solar hot water system. The farmers are making more money now having wind farms than growing food. We must have mass transit systems. Every family should be subsidised to have a hybrid car. We need cars with fuel cells that run on water with two electrodes and they generate hydrogen. This is all here. So our roadmap will consist of an array of alternatives: geothermal, hydro, wave, tidal, cogeneration, solar, wind, and conservation. And Americans can save 28% of the electricity they use. You do not need clothes dryers. The reason you use them is because General Electric made them, because they make nuclear reactors and you've got to use their electricity somehow. Hang your clothes out and dry them under the nuclear reactor in the sky. In Atlanta, there are laws against hanging your underpants outside because it's rude. And Mrs. Brown might see them next door. That's ridiculous. I've always dried my clothes outside, and if it rains, you wait till the rain goes and the sun comes out and dries up all the rain, and incy-wincy spider climbs up the pipe again. In the winter, if you've got a furnace and you heat your house, you hang them by the furnace in the winter. Don't use clothes dryers. And the implements we use now, computers, DVDs, VCRs, all the things that have lights on during the night, what we think are asleep, suck up 5 to 10% of the electricity that we use. Turn them off. I noticed in this college, I went into a place and the light turned off and then on and then it turned off. But turn the lights off. Only have one light in the room in which you're working at night. Turn off all the globes. All of them. I've become an ecological fascist. And I have no lights on in my house except where I am. And I tell my granddaughter, who's 13, Rachel, turn your lights off. Turn the light off in the bath. Don't leave them on. Don't you want a future? And she says, oh, Grandma. So it's hard to educate my grandchildren, let alone any. And my daughter, she's a bit refractory too, and she's a doctor. I live next door to her. She respects me, but, you know, they don't always do what they should be doing for their future. So there are lots of ways I've got to save energy in this book. You can save 28% of the electricity you currently use. Now, I've got to end with one thing. You know how North Korea might or might not have blown up a nuclear weapon, and I hear they did another one today? The New York Times is saying the first one is only half a kiloton. The Hiroshima bomb was 13 kilotons. So they don't know if it was a mass of chemical explosives or nuclear. Tell me, has anyone got any information about the one that they exploded today? What are they saying? Is it big, little? We don't know. Are you serious? Thanks God. I'm not going to go into all the devious mechanisms that this administration has used to isolate a paranoid, clinically paranoid man called Kim Jong-il. All he wanted was a non-aggression treaty with America, so they promised they wouldn't invade or bomb him. And the Pentagon has sort of set this up. But there's a lot of documents in here from the Pentagon. But he's been pushed into doing this. But you know who the true rogue states are? Of the 30,000 nuclear weapons in the world today, Russia and America own 97% of them. and Russia has you targeted with 2,500 hydrogen bombs. I'll drop a bomb on New York. No, I'll drop a bomb on Claremont. You need to know that tonight there could be a nuclear war, and that every town and city with a population of 50,000 or more is targeted with at least one bomb from Russia, even though they're your best friends, and I'll explain why in a minute. The weapon takes only a half an hour to go from launch to landing here. It will come in at 20 times the speed of sound. You know, sometimes you've got your radio on and you hear, woo. We are just testing the emergency broadcasting system. This time they'd say, this is not a test. We are under nuclear attack. Run to the nearest fallout shelter. Do you know where there is one? We're targeted like we were in the Cold War, exactly the same. It'll come at 20 times the speed of sound. You won't hear it. It will explode, let's say this is the epicenter, right here with the heat inside the center of the sun, dig a hole 3/4 of a mile wide and 800 feet deep, turning all that rock and earth to radioactive fallout in the mushroom cloud. Out to 5 miles, everyone will be vaporized, like that little boy, and turned into gas. Out to 20 miles, everyone will be grotesquely burnt. Hospitals destroyed, no doctors. People lying in what is left of the streets in intense agony. No morphine, although the White House has been stockpiling morphine in case of nuclear war. We don't know where it is, and our syringes will be melted and will be similarly dead or injured. If you look at the flash 50 miles away, you'll be instantly and permanently blinded. And then the whole area will be engulfed in a most extraordinary firestorm. Huge temperatures. So if you're in for 3,000 square miles, if you're in a fallout shelter, the oxygen will be sucked out of the shelter and you'll be asphyxiated. I just dropped one. There are 40 such bombs targeted on New York City. As I speak, Robert McNamara and I wrote an article for the LA Times about that recently. 60 on Washington, D.C. And President Yeltsin got to within 10 seconds of launching his nuclear arsenal in 1995 when he made a mistake and thought a Norwegian missile was a first strike by America. You've got 5,200 or more hydrogen bombs on your missiles ready to go. I flew over the missile silos the other day in Nevada and looked down, and there they all were. In each missile silo are two men aged 18 to 21, each with a pistol, one to shoot the other if one shows signs of deviant behavior. There are two locks 12 feet apart, so one man can't turn both locks, but they work out if they tie a string to the one key, but a man can turn both locks. George Bush gets 3 minutes to decide whether or not to press the button. Do you know what the football is? If you watch the president, always walking just behind him at a convenient distance is a man with a suitcase, with a computer to start a nuclear war. When Reagan was shot, they lost the football for 2 days. When Bush met with the late Pope, sitting between their legs underneath the table sat the football to destroy God's creation. Because it only takes 1,000 bombs blowing up 100 cities and burning them to create such toxic black radioactive smoke, it blankets the earth with a cloud so thick it blocks out the sun for a year, causing a short ice age, and everything and everyone will die except maybe the cockroaches that are very radio resistant. America's still got a policy to fight and win a preemptive secret nuclear war against Russia. The Russians are clinically suitably paranoid, never knowing when you might strike. On 9/11, you got to the third highest state of nuclear alert because no one knew what was happening. So any international anxiety in the world could trigger the exchange between the superpowers. They're the only nations that can destroy life on Earth, yet they're running around with a microscope listening, ooh, there's one. What about that one? What about Iran? The only nations that can destroy life on Earth are Russia and America. Israel's got the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world. She has not signed the non-proliferation treaty. She's a rogue state. Pakistan and India have suitable arsenals. They'll probably have a nuclear war between them and kill millions of people. That's predicted. They have not signed the non-proliferation treaty yet. Bush is setting up a big treaty with India to sell them and give them nuclear equipment, which violates the non-proliferation treaty. France, China, and Russia have arsenals, and they've said, If Russia and America disarm, they will too. There's a precedent. Reagan, who I met with for an hour and a quarter in the White House in 1983 and held his hand for most of that time and established a doctor-patient relationship with him because he didn't know anything. Nice old man, but didn't know anything. He actually worked with Gorbachev, and he and Gorbachev, over a weekend in Reykjavik, almost agreed to abolish nuclear weapons. So there's a precedent. Clinton is the one who left the weapons in place. He had no courage. He didn't take on the military. He smoked some dope. He didn't inhale, though. And he didn't go to Vietnam, so he didn't have the courage. He's a nice man. He's smart, but he had no courage. And his legacy is that the weapons remain in, on hair trigger alert, ready to go with the press of a button, and the Cold War is hot. And that's the elephant in the sitting room, which no one talks about. It's a state of schizophrenia in a societal sense. There's a split between reality and perception of reality, and everyone's worried about North Korea. It's crazy. I'm going to end by showing you something, and I need about 4 or 5 volunteers that can hop up on the stage with me. I'll tell you when to come. Now, you have, as well as missile silos, you've got 18 Trident submarines, 14 of which are nuclear. In each Trident submarine, there are 24 missiles. On each missile are 8 hydrogen bombs. Each hydrogen bomb is 10 to 40 times larger than the Hiroshima bomb that killed 120,000 people. You've got 14 of these, and I'm going to show you one Trident submarine. Each page represents one missile of 8 hydrogen bombs, 10 to 40 times larger than the Hiroshima bomb. So come on, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. Come on. 4 volunteers. You, and you. So here's a Trident sub. Take it in and know there are 14 roving the seas at any time silently beneath the oceans. Okay, go. Come up and hold it so we hold it right up, yeah. Do you ever see that on Fox? Do you ever see that on CNN? Do you ever hear Hannity talking about it? This is the reality of the world in which we live, and no one will discuss it. We can get rid of these weapons. Okay, thanks awfully. So tonight I'm starting a new organization called Students for Survival. And it's going to be started at Scripps College. And you're going to mobilize the whole college. This was taped tonight, so you can play it to all the classes. It needs to be mandatory. There's a film called Helen's War, made by my skeptical niece, Anna, following around her mad old aunt, who's an anti-nuclear bag lady, saying, who do you think you are? You know, skeptical generation X or Y. And we have some major fights. It's an hour long, and it's a very provocative, but a film that inspires particularly young people, and it was made at the start of the Iraqi invasion, where I said babies are going to be cut apart by cluster bombs. And I actually saw it last night. I hadn't seen it for a while, and I wept because it becomes more pertinent by the day. Get that film from my website, nuclearpolicy.org. Play it to all the classes. For the faculty here, play it. They like it. But it will turn them on. Then you go to every college in the Claremont area and turn them on. All revolutions are led by students. If you want to survive, if you want a future that's safe and you can smell the orange blossom and maybe have babies and do what you need to do and live a normal lifespan, you will join this movement. I'll help you, and we'll have a revolution of the students across America. All they need is education. And I'll end with what your wonderful President Jefferson said, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. And I know once you're informed, you'll act to save your lives. And you won't practice psychic numbing anymore. And if this country turns around, you'll save the planet. This country can be the most powerful, most important country in the world. At the moment, it's not. But I believe that people came from the four corners of the earth to America to do one thing, and that's now, and that's to save the earth. And that's you. Thank you.
This was produced by the LA Sound Posse and may be freely copied and distributed. You can visit us on the web at lasoundposse.org.